We're on a mission to explore how emerging technologies, media, robotics, and data and behavioral science will solve humanity's most pressing challenges. From education, mobility, energy, food and water supplies, the environment, employment, all the way to disease and basic human rights. Nothing is off limits. This episode is brought to you by Beverage Universe. They have every flavor to help you stay young, beautiful, and thirsty. Go to beverageuniverse.com for your next flavor experience.
I am excited to introduce our guest today, Tony Sales. Tony is currently the Director of Strategic Development for We Fight Fraud. Tony is known as a reformed fraudster and one of very few people to have ever worked at the summits of both organized crime, fraud, and loss prevention. He specializes in fraud prevention, social engineering, organized crime, data security, physical security, hacking, and cybercrime and crime intelligence. Tony Sales also walked away with £30 million using hacked personal data and now spends his time helping organizations test their e-commerce systems, their security systems, their cybersecurity protocol, and so on. He's known as Britain's greatest fraudster by the British media and has the unique skill set that is extremely valuable to any major organization looking to prevent fraud and other cybercrime. When most kids are testing out their first jobs as dog sitting or babysitting, Tony's first encounter with cybercrime was at the age of 13, and he's going to tell us a bit more about his story on this episode. But he tested out different credit card scams at the age of as early as 13, and eventually he spent some time behind bars, he reformed, he turned his life around, and now spends his time advising organizations on cybersecurity. Tony, welcome.
Hello, Terry. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I am super excited to dive into your fascinating story during this unprecedented time of increased crime rates, COVID-19, lockdowns, social unrest in the United States, and I hear it's spilling over into London and into England as a whole and into Italy and probably as we speak right now in many other countries. If there ever was a time to increase our awareness of cybersecurity and organized crime, it is now. So we really appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge and experience with our audience today. So I wanted to start off with just chatting a bit about your background and how did you find cybersecurity, or how did cybersecurity find you?
I'd actually, I come out of prison, and in prison I've decided that I was going to get involved in loss prevention, asset protection as I know it now. I mean, I didn't even know the names of what it was called back then. And I got out and just kind of hit Google and was just literally tapping away retail fraud, retail crime, banking crime. And I started to notice that there was lots of different forums and events that took place that I was really kind of unaware of before, you know. As a fraudster, you kind of never look behind you at what's coming. You're just going forward. You're never looking at what's behind you to take you away. And I reached out to a conference. I was really lucky, really. I actually went to a meeting and met some guys from Vice who asked me if I wanted to make a documentary. So I agreed eventually to make a documentary called How to Get Away with Stealing. That documentary went viral. I then approached this company to talk there and sent them a short video of the stuff on How to Get Away with Stealing. And the guy rang me back within 20 minutes and was like, wow, we'd really like you to speak. So I'd never done anything like getting, I didn't know how I was going to get into that world. Obviously knew I had a good skill set to use, but I didn't know how or who to get to. So I went along to this conference and I just kind of poured my heart out on stage. And just the audience was stunned. I remember looking there thinking, must be really bad. Yeah. And walked off stage, and then I was mobbed for like 3 hours, and stood doing a Q&A for 3 hours. And someone was standing in the background that was really commercially astute, understood how the market worked. And yeah, he approached me and said, did I want to do some, would I do some stuff with them? And I was like, yeah, definitely. I'd definitely be interested. They said that they could pitch my services out to retailers who were interested. Penetration testing wasn't a thing then. It was digitally, but physically people were just kind of doing walk rounds and stuff and not mixing the two. So I kind of come along and mixed both the data world with the digital world and the physical world, and kind of said, look, I'm just going to steal all your data because that's the most valuable asset that you have. And once I'd done that, my name started to get bigger, and you know, I would go and do bigger and bolder things, just try, you know, I just came out with just things the way that I see. Criminals see things very differently, because it's when you grow up in something, your mindsets are in a very different place. So that becomes very valuable, like you so rightly said, to many companies.
So let's talk about that. So how would you describe what your childhood was like growing up?
I had a good childhood, in fairness. I mean, you know, but it's what people, I know that there's worse of people than me, that, you know, bad stuff happened to other people as well. So at 2 days old, my mum gave me away to my grandmother. She was 17, my mum, when she had me. She's a young girl still. And I suppose that creates a lot of mummy issues. As a male, needing that love and bond and that stuff, you know, my dad had left. I didn't have a mum or a dad. I've got my nan and granddad that are both amazing. You know, they're dead now, God bless them. But they are amazing people that just took me on as their own. And I grew up with my nan, but you know, the clothes that they would buy me would be kind of the older, I would be the kid that would be dressed in the plimsolls that were, you know, 99 pence. And you know, they didn't really have much money. My nan really, I mean, I never had McDonald's until I was 16. It's a good thing. Yeah, definitely. And my nan was always, you know, good home cooked food, loads of vegetables and all of that kind of stuff. But as a kid, when you're mixing with other kids that have all the nice trainers, the Nikes, the Adidas, the all the bits that they've got, I wanted that. Yeah, I kind of wanted that. And right. Then, of course, you see other boys going with girls and asking the girls out, you know, like kind of all those big movies that you see in the States, right, of the proms. Yes. And, you know, I wanted to be that kid that could ask a girl out and she'd want to go out with me. But, of course, I asked a girl out to go out with me and she just looked me up and down and was kind of like, go away, you little tramp. And that causes a whole load of different stuff to happen. Now, I mean, previously before that, you know, I was, my uncle, my mum's brother, also lived with my nan. And so I felt that I had an older brother, but, you know, he was probably a bit jealous of me in certain places, maybe. As an adult now, I can reflect on that and look back at that as something that definitely molded me into becoming a criminal, because I was always a person that they would put up to do stuff. So, you know, for instance, when I was 7 years old, I get lowered into a pub from the hatch on the roof of the pub with a piece of rope with my uncle and his crew, who tell me to open the door. And of course, when I open the door, they rob the pub. That is my, you know, there's many, many other things that have happened in between there to me going and that moment, that epiphany moment that makes me go, right, how do I steal money? Was kind of being led down a path already. I mean, it's a real funny one. Nature nurture is a real, you know, I've learned to understand so much about trauma. And you know, I had sexual abuse as a child. There's lots of stuff that goes on that creates, it's just something within us as humans that, you know, it would take me a lot of years to get over that. But there is, people always say to me, yeah, I really try and think like a fraudster. And my instant reaction is always, I'm really sorry to hear that. And people always look at me like a bit astounded, like, what's he talking about? But I know the pain and suffering that I went through as a child. yeah, that you can't just be a criminal. It's not something you can just be. If you decent, hardworking, honest parents, yeah, don't bring their children up to be criminals, yeah? It's not a choice. And I think that that's, history shows us that. We can look at every single murder case ever, yeah? There's trauma, yeah? There's not a psychologist or psychiatrist on the planet that's going to tell us any different. All the times we look at crime from that type of angle, you know, of demons, bad, punish, put away. All the, I mean, you guys in the States are amazing at looking at it in a different way. Here in the UK, we're still stuck in the ancient times, it seems, of where we just lock everyone up and throw away the key because they're intrinsically bad, you know? If I would have been gotten at a young age, yeah, some of the stuff that I could have taught the financial institutions around the world would have been mass. I would have been seen as a financial genius, probably, yeah, because of some of the stuff that we could have created. But I probably wouldn't have had the experience of being able to do that if I hadn't been through the crime part of it. So it's kind of always that kind of play off. I hope that makes sense. I can see you nodding away there.
Yeah, I mean, understanding the financial systems and the financial backbone, and then also the aspect of social engineering of how you actually get around certain barriers that are created by institutions at such a young age. Personally, I think that that is absolutely a brilliant type of mind can do that. You know, in which direction you take it in depends on your experience and depends on what limitations you feel that have been put in front of you. So I feel that if that option was even there, I mean, back then that job didn't even exist when you already knew how to do that. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
There was no such place to go.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that, you know, where do you kind of go for that? You don't, it's a really strange one, you know, because you kind of, you feel that, I always felt that I was different and I saw the world in a different way right from a very young age. I would ask questions. Yeah. I mean, at 7 years old, again, my grandmother takes me to Morocco and I actually got to swim in the king's pool because I was asking so many questions. The king of Morocco had overheard me asking them about the swimming pool because I swim like a fish, right? I should have definitely been a professional swimmer. And because I was so obsessed with the water, he allowed me to go in the pool. And that's all questions. It's all about, and even now, I always question everything, whether that be the law, whether that be what's happening around COVID, whether that be in just walking down the road, I question absolutely everything. It's always been a massive part of who I am.
Curiosity. Yeah, so tell us a bit about some of the first, like the beginning of some of the things that you were involved in. What types of opportunities were there that you were able to kind of manipulate?
So, I mean, it, you know, like at 13, it starts with going door to door and sponsorship forms, right? But what I'm learning at that time is how to obtain data. How to obtain personal information, right? So if you go to someone's door, you need their name, address, and how much they're going to sponsor you for, right? So, you know, kind of in today's GDPR terms, you'd kind of be one piece of information away from having to be on the ICO register as someone who obtains data. You know, back then, people didn't understand what data was. But you know, I very quickly grew that into opening up video. You remember the old VHS videos that we all used to use every, you know, all the time?
Right.
I opened up loads of VHS video accounts, yeah, in fake names that we'd found from people that we'd got on the sponsorship forms. Like, there's so many, and it just morphs. And then I figured out how to, so again, you know, back then that was Ritz Video, which were in the early days of videos before Blockbuster took them all over. We figured out that if you pressed F9, F10, return on the computer, it would wipe off the video. So we would steal the videos from the Dropbox, yeah, that everyone puts the lazy videos in where they don't want to go in the shop. We'd steal the videos out of there because the flap was quite open, go in the store, go to the computer, cause a distraction with the member of staff and just lean over, scan the video, F9, F10, return. And that was the video back in the company as far as they were concerned. But, you know, those videos back then, I had a guy that would buy every single video I got for 20 quid. You could nick at least 10 videos a day. Now you're into 200 quid. As a 14, 15-year-old boy, and there's four of us doing it, yeah? Like, it's just how you make money and then you move on to the next segment. And then because you're doing little bits and pieces, you've got a little bit of money, we're dressing different now, I can buy my clothes, I could, you know, I spent £125 on a chippy jacket, yeah? Just it was reversible because I was like, yes, like, oh wow, I've kind of finally made it. And I bought myself a pair of pink Nike Air, yeah, when they first come out with the little air bubble in them, yeah. The pink ones, they were pink and blue, they're amazing. And I bought myself a pair of CRX Reeboks in pink as well. I must have had a fascination with pink. And you dress better, you start to feel better, people start to look at you differently. And that then really kind of helped my move up within the criminal world. So then at 15, I meet a guy who's into credit cards. He shows, you know, me and my friends how to clone credit cards. We was buying them just as we used to get them on, just with the magnetic strip on the back, yeah, just with the track two information. And in the UK, you used to get like a Argos Premier points card. So Argos is a store here, like a retailer store, where you would save these points up just like Green Shield stamps, yeah? And then you would buy some cups or you could buy some plates or whatever it is. We figured out that magnetic strip would hold the credit card information on the back as well, yeah? So we would go around and get people that we knew in stores. So we'd find people that worked in petrol garages, in little restaurants, in all different types of places that were taking the magnetic swipes back then. And we would just use them. You know, we would go and swipe through and say that, you know, swipe through for 100 quid, give us 50 quid back. You know, the person in the shop gets to put a £100 ticket in, of which they can get 50 quid back for because the money's gone into their bank. Yeah. So it just all plays on the internal staff. And then upscaling, you start to get greedy, you start to, like all businesses, yeah, you start to become entrepreneurial and think, how can I maximize more of that data? How can I achieve more of that data? What else can I do with the data? So and what else can I do with the people that I'm paying money to every week? And then I kind of came up with an idea that we could put them in shops, we could get these little grabbers. So you could get like a little grabber that you could just place in your hand. And if you then came to me and I'm working in a shop, you give me your card, I swipe your card through my grabber. That just takes an imprint, a digital print of your card that can hold up to 3,000 numbers. Yeah. So now a waitress can have that in her pocket. You pay in a restaurant, you're quite swiped. You know, and by the time I've kind of come to the end of that, I had over 300 people working in restaurants throughout London. Wow. And the southeast, because it was massively upscalable. And you start to learn about plastic and about how to punch credit cards and how to buy blank faces, how to print blank faces, how to corrupt people in places where blank faces are made. You learn so much stuff, and money takes you to the next level every single time. The more money you got, for some reason, in people take you more seriously. You're not a time waster, you know. And I was making a lot of money back then, and so I was able to move up the ranks quite quickly.
And then what were some of the next things that happened after that? So you were scaling and growing, and it was becoming a business, basically.
It was the credit card companies were getting smarter as well, right? So, you know, we knew that they could get. So back then, right? Let's say I've cloned five cards from one restaurant, right? Two of those cards then go and get used in another restaurant. Yeah. Every number that I've got from that other restaurant from there on out is going to get referred, because the credit card company kind of played the variables out. Yeah. And knew that, no, there must be likelihood, just refer that. And then back then the phone would ring on the PDQ terminals and whoever was working in the shop would pick it up and say, is the customer there? Can you hand them the phone? and confirm them the details, right? We all remember that stuff happening. So as that's evolving in the background, you've got interest-free credit, store cards, all coming up in the background, the rise of the subprime market and the whole greed of the market to make everyone get financed, to become indebted to the system, that goes right into my hands. There was big giants back then, G Capital, that would just on ball in a heartbeat, yeah, that would just take every bit of business that they can, and you could hit them, you know, four or five times with the same profile before they actually realized they were being hit because the paperwork trail was so slow to get to them. So people's information, people didn't realize you could use that in that way then. They didn't realize that people would go in store and impersonate people. Yeah, identity theft is still not a thing globally. There's no charge anywhere for identity theft as one thing. They charge you as different parts of it, right? So it's, I mean, you guys have it more right than anyone because it's a federal offense, and the sentencing is a lot higher because of the understanding of what can actually happen. But once you get into a place where we was at, you know, I was going out every week buying at least 400 or 500 driving licenses, 400 or 500 utility bills. I had a whole factory that I employed people at that worked there and made those documents for me. You know, like we would, I had a whole fleet of vans and cars that would go out and pick all the goods up to bring it all back. Because if you're going to be involved in organized retail crime, you don't want to get caught. You know, the links, the last thing you want to do is get caught. But the more time that you have, the more complacent you become, the more lax you become with the stuff that you're doing, and you just think you're never going to get caught. And of course, that's where the cops win, right? Because they know time is going to come and bite us all in the bum at some point when you're looking over your shoulder every single day, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, weeks turn into months, months turn into years, and you're still in the same position. You know, it's like, and then you have to find other means. The money that I've made, the money that I've accumulated, I'm now using to stay safe, to stay not. You know, my wife was pregnant when I went on the run. So I had three boys up until that point. I knew my wife was going to have a girl. I didn't want to miss the bonding period with my daughter. I was willing to sacrifice a bit more prison time for that. And I did. I got three extra months when I was finally caught for that. I'm glad I went on the run and didn't miss the bonding period with my daughter. However, I definitely wished I would have gone to prison and not gone on the run, and changed my life around from that point onwards, because I probably wouldn't have been as damaged as what I am now. Emotionally, that 6 years really took a strain on me, and my family, of course.
6 years is a long time. I mean, you know, I couldn't imagine, but I would assume there would be a lot of psychological and mental stress, you know, just constantly being under some type of pressure.
This episode is brought to you by Ready Mask. A lot of us are looking to protect the health of our employees and our office guests, as well as ourselves. Ready Mask's new unique and innovative line of comfortable and strapless N95 masks are available on their website. That's readimask.com. Check them out and social distance in style. If you like our discussions and would like to support our efforts, be sure to subscribe on Patreon, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, or YouTube. If you have an idea about a topic or know someone who would be a great guest, reach out on our website, amplifiedpodcast.com.
So what happened at the end of the 6 years? I assume the investigators...
I'd actually gone to see one of my friends, and we was meeting in a petrol garage in Essex, and I drove down there, and I had a pair of shorts on. It was a hot summer's day, a pair of shorts, flip-flops. I've gone into the petrol garage, and as I walked in, there was two police officers sitting down having their lunch. And I could just feel them looking at me. You know, I could just feel it. I went outside and then I went to get back in my car. And literally as I turned around to open and open the door to get in the car, they were walking over to me. And they were like, "Can we have a word, please, sir?" So I gave them the name that I'd been using for quite a while, that I'd given before previously when I'd been stopped by police, that was Clean. And as soon as I gave that name, they slapped the handcuffs on me. And was kind of like, and instantly I felt tired. I felt like it's over. Like, I know I'm going to go back to the police station at this point, and I know that, you know, once they put the live scan fingerprint on me, they're going to get me. They're going to know who I am, and it's all over. So I sat down on the curb, and the police officer actually said to me, "Are you all right? Like, is everything okay?" And I said, "Yeah, just like, you'll see when we get back to the station." And he said, "I can already see, I can see relief coming off your face. Something's not right." And he was right. But, you know, I then get remanded in custody, obviously, and get taken back to the courthouse where I'd gone on the run for, where I hadn't realised, you know, the last day of the trial. So my co-defendant went on the run, who they had at number one in the trial, and he got caught before me. So one of the other guys that was in the trial with us had got cancer. And so the judge set a precedent with him by giving him 18 months probation. Yes, which meant that they could only sentence me to a maximum of 15 months. So when I went to the court, I kind of just was honest with the judge, and he gave me 12 months. You know, I just said to him exactly what I said to you about my daughter, and just said, "Look, I'm not lying about it. My wife's sitting over there, like, my daughter's there. I lie. That's the truth of it. Like, that's how it was." Yeah. And they accepted that. And I suppose that where I've been on the run for all that time, I'm now going to prison. I'm now in prison. Yeah. I want to change my life around. Where am I going to go? I'm coming out of jail with, you know, I'm coming into jail with, I've kind of spent nearly all the money. We've been trying to, I've been doing, living this big lifestyle, lying to my wife for all that time. And then they come to visit me. My wife didn't talk to me for 3 months because she didn't know she was on the run herself. So after the court case, she didn't come to see me. And then she came on the visit, and she, as she walks onto the visit, she's holding my son's hand, who's crying. And it's at that point I realized, oh, wow, look, I'm doing what's happened to me to him. I'm giving the trauma that I've got, and that's not fair. Like, how do I break that circle? So I went back to the wing, and kind of at that point I knew, right, now I'm going to get into loss prevention. And that's how it all happened. So, which didn't go down too well on the wing, actually. But
it's an absolutely fascinating story. I mean, the experiences that you've had, I think ultimately, as difficult as they have been, have brought you to a place where, you know, you're using a very unique skill set that you have to still do that, the talent, you're still utilizing the talent that you have, just in a different way. And it's so interesting how life works sometimes. It has these twists and turns, and you end up right where you should have been the whole time. Yes. Except that back then there would, you know, such a career did not exist, because we were just at the beginning of all of these systems being built and created. And, you know, kind of brings me to today. So what do you do today?
So I kind of still get to do what I used to do, only now that, like, I'm a bit of a better businessman, I would hope now. And I, you know, we do a lot of penetration testing. We do a lot of physical penetration testing. We exploit vulnerabilities in systems. We break into banks. We break into retailers. We get to do all of that kind of crime stuff. But this time we record everything we do. We write in-depth reports about everything. And, you know, my business partners, so my My business partner is the ex-head of fraud and counterterrorism for New Scotland Yard. He's massively influential within those markets. And one of my other business partners is a 22-year-old super hacker who himself was in a little bit of trouble when he was a young kid. He's still a young kid, but an amazing young kid. And so we have a real good dynamic team that teach companies how to stay safe in a pragmatic way. Every single test is different. Every single time, for instance, one time I was employed to steal a lorry, right? Not everything's digital, right? We still have to get goods around the country. We still have to move stuff everywhere. That normally takes place in lorries. So the LP team had actually been looking to steal their own lorry and had tried it on numerous different occasions. Within 24 hours, I stole three. Because I worked out that, the guy was taking the keys home in his bag. So I went and stole a bag of keys, copied the keys, put the keys back, and then allowed them to fill up all three lorries and then just drove off the forecourt with the lorries while the drivers went to get their paperwork. And it was that simple. Those criminal insights, onboarding at the moment in COVID, right? So if you're a bank, home, yeah? It's a massive flaw within 20. So on day one of lockdown, we was actually on day one of a pen test. And on that day, we found a flaw in the back end of a bank that would have allowed us to open bank accounts at will digitally, which means that if you get into terrorist financing and stuff, like those bank accounts are worth absolute fortunes because they are accounts that would have allowed us to send huge amounts of money, keep an eye on if anyone's flagging those accounts, to a criminal, terrorist, malicious network. Those things are extremely valuable, and of course can be massively damaging for the reputation of many banks or whoever it is that's done that, and they also get fined massive amounts of money. So that's kind of
what, yes, those are some of my next questions. So based on what's happening today in this environment that we're in, between the lockdowns taking place in New Jersey, where I'm at, we've been on lockdown, I think, for about 3 months now. They're just starting to open up businesses. I think they're saying June 15th, but, who knows? At the same time, you have all of this social unrest and riots taking place. So, businesses are not just under attack through cyber pathways, but also through physical vandalism and physical break-ins right now. What would you say is your perspective on what can companies do to either proactively anticipate where they could potentially be hit through cyber or through, as I call it, the last mile problem, which is what you just described with the keys and the driver? What are some ways that they can test themselves or just pay attention?
I find a lot of companies are really good at processes, right? But the processes don't get carried out in the right places where they need to be carried out. So great processes made in ivory towers that don't actually play out in the places where they're needed can create massive problems. So, for instance, most people don't realize that their reception is probably their most vulnerable point, and they should, because they think they have a guard at reception. Yeah, well, that all plays into a criminal's hands, because I'm going to look at the guard and find, what's the vulnerability with the guard? We all see it in the Hollywood films of stuff that happens, yeah? So within minutes, I'm able to find out where they live, what they do, what time they come in. How do I stall them from getting in? How can I make their day bad? How can I divert their attention throughout their day for that one moment in time that I'm going to create the master moment, right? And it's all about any big scam, any big bank robbery, any breaking of a store, unless it's mob mentality. The mob mentality is just kind of really difficult to stop, because rushing stores is just, you know, we've seen it for many years. It's something that you can't compete against because there's so many people rushing in. You know, on those occasions, it shutters down time and you have to just accept the losses. And that then plays back into the greed of the retailer or the greed of the company that may want to open their doors, right? In COVID right now, I mean, all the buildings are empty. And what happens is people think, oh, well, there's police out there watching the road. You know, and the criminals won't be able to move about. Well, of course they can. The criminals are smart. All those letters that everyone gets to movement letters, what do you think the criminals haven't got them? Of course they've had them on day one. Yeah, because they need to move their drugs. They need to move, or because their line's going to stop earning money. Yeah, they can't furlough their staff. They don't have those options. Yeah, they can't do that. So they have to continue making money. But now, if I'm out and I've got an NHS ID, a healthcare worker's ID, if I've got a letter that allows me to be a critical worker, I'm a journalist, whatever that may be, companies send those letters out unencrypted, free open source out to everywhere. Some companies even put them on their websites for their staff to download, right? Well, if you think criminals aren't looking at that, then you've got to be mad. And that is a perfect example of decent, hardworking, honest people making decisions at times when you don't need decent, hardworking, honest people to make decisions. You know, it goes back to that same stuff that I said to you about childhood. You know, someone sitting there can't understand. Everyone thinks, why does someone go and rob a store? Why do they hit the foot lockers to nick the trainers? Because they can't afford the trainers. Yeah, and if they've got an opportunity to get loads of them, criminal gangs will jump onto that because trainers sell like hotcakes on the black market, as everyone knows. No tags, no digital trace, no none of that stuff. All of that stuff then becomes sellable, yeah? In the last riots in the UK, lots of criminals got arrested because they stole Blackberries. Well, criminals learn from their mistakes and don't do that anymore. They steal the stuff that they know they can sell on that's not going to get reported back to them. Or there's so much of it globally that no one's ever going to see that that come from a stolen bit. You know, and that's how the criminal world always evolves and stays ahead. You know, they learn from what happens, whereas the law enforcement and companies have to learn multiple times. You know, most companies won't even see a breach till it's already happened. You know, that today, the most important part of any company, whether you sell trainers, beer, yeah, or whatever else, is your client database, because that's how you sell trainers, right? Instagram, Facebook, the internet is alive with loads of different stores all selling everyone's different products, right? Criminals worked out a way how to circumvent the security processes that are put in there to stop that from happening, to stop all of those. Every time that someone comes up with something, verify, yeah, two-factor ID, you know, three-factor authentications, like SIM swap. Yeah, all of this stuff, no matter all the time you're putting your security in someone else's hand, you've lost. There's no way, yeah? So that's like me saying, Terry, could you please come around and just sort out the security on my front door, right? You know nothing about where I live, the area that I live in, who's the people to watch out for the area, what way is the best way into my building. The best person for me to do that is me, right? Or someone that burgles my buildings, someone that understands how to get into the building that I work in or live in, yeah? And we see a lot of these parameters that get set across the internet. So there's some huge companies out there, right, that sell into companies, right? So, for instance, you have CyberSource and DataCash, right? One's MasterCard, one's Visa, right? Mm-hmm. And they sell companies, they sell this service that will allow a company to have what they call white or blacklist. I believe they're changing those names now, yeah? And on those lists, you have people that have been good or bad email addresses. You have credit card numbers that may be good or bad. You have address information that may be good or bad. Yeah, well, all of that stuff is a buildup of open source information and information gathered from the clients that Visa or whoever else may add. But if I come along and just play to the same tone as what that data is supposed to, and just play with the same pattern as what that data is supposed to have, how does anyone know? If in a breach, let's say tomorrow, we hit a company and stole all of their credit card information. That's new credit card information that that system can't then pick up on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. EasyJet got bought for 9 million the other day, yeah? 9 million pieces of information, yeah? I still think that people don't really understand data today. I still think, you know, the way that you and I are talking right now, right, is that I know your name and your full name because it's on there. I know what you do for a living. I've got your phone number. I now have clinical pieces of information to socially engineer you.
Okay? Uh-oh.
So, you know, yes. That's kind of all you need. And it's always going to be a battle. You know, like criminals will always find another way around stuff to find stuff. And that, and I try and make people understand the data that they are. You know, we are all a piece of data. Every single piece of us should be kept private as much as it possibly can. Yeah. And we give it away.
Have you started looking into blockchain type of technology for identity theft or identity protection? And how do you Yes. see that playing into the future?
It just depends how it all comes about. You know, like I get approached by a lot of these guys that are involved in blockchain, and sometimes they're there shaking their head with things that I'm saying, yeah? But blockchain was created by the criminal market, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, so that means it's quite secure. You're all adapting it because it's quite secure, right? But the problem is with it relies upon people, right? So we're back to the chicken and egg scenario. So how do you know all the people in that chain are trusted? How do you know a genius hasn't mapped out who's within that chain? Yeah, there's so much still questions that people don't ask because now blockchain's being made by decent, hardworking, honest people. Yeah, they don't involve people, which was my point with the lists. Setting those parameters, yeah, should always include people that have been down that road. Because if someone works in a company and they're setting a parameter for what their fraud controls look like, yes, they may be the greatest loss prevention officer on the planet. Yeah. But what they can't do is predict how to do a crime. They might know how to defraud their own business in certain ways, but the criminals don't look for them ways, and they're the ones that you block. They're the ones that get around the systems that you put in place. So we need to be smarter with the people that we employ, and giving some people an opportunity, yeah, to actually do stuff like that. You know, there's many reform people out there that kind of do these things, you know, and I think that those people should be given opportunities, definitely.
That's a very interesting point, because I have this discussion a lot when it comes specifically for machine learning algorithms or artificial intelligence algorithms that are being created right now, where some of the issues that are being brought up is that the pattern of thought is not diverse enough, where the algorithm is created based on the architect and the coder and the developer and the
chaos scientist. Theory. Humans have chaos.
Exactly.
You can't program chaos theory, right? So I've had conversations with Oxford University, with Cambridge University, and with MIT, right? And they all try to get to that exact data set of how to spot it, to figure it out, yeah? But you can't program human nature, yeah? And if we're going to learn AI, because that's the holy grail, that's where we all want to go, yeah? But once we program it so it learns in that way, you know, we're opening up another massive can of worms. So I think you can get close to it. I think there's definitely, we've actually been creating something what we call We Fight Fraud's Dark Matter. So that's a total understanding of, you know, just like how these guys supply the information in the same way, we can do that exactly the same, but lay it on top of their systems, yeah? And then filter the information through us. And our result will be, because it's in the way that we think about things, in a bit different. But still, we can't program chaos theory. We can just program how we think, but the data sets that you need to get that don't exist. So you're kind of in a, you know, you're grabbing data sets from places that we know are better to grab data sets from than the average person that may go and get them there. And that's key to it all.
So what is one place that you feel is almost impossible to break into?
Nothing is impossible to break into.
Any
company wants to pay the resources and the time, yeah, will gladly break into them at any point they want.
Right. So is it just a matter of time? Is it a matter of resources? A matter of pressure? Is it, you know, do you prefer brute force over, you know, let's say, for example, a really, I mean, anybody with $5 can launch a DOS attack against an organization in 1 minute. I can do it if I want to. What is some of the more prevalent ways that people try to attack server or business? Are these DDoS attacks, brute force attacks that we see, are they premeditated towards a specific company or store or business, or are they just happening randomly across the board? You know, what is the pattern?
Yeah, so it's randomly across the board, right? So at the moment, you've got loads, everyone's locked up. Even the hackers are locked up. So they've got more time to do more stuff, right? So the more time that they've got, the more things they're going to do. Hence EasyJet. This is just a start, right? There's not a single computer on the planet serving a prison sentence. Not one. Yeah?
That's a very good quote. Wow. Yes. That's true.
So that tells you everything you need to know. It's a human. Yeah. Computers don't commit crime. People do. That's our motto at We Fight Fraud, right? So it's always going to be a human. The weakness is always going to be a human. Yeah. The vulnerability only exists because of a human. So only a human can find it and repair it or exploit it. Yeah. The difference between criminals and loss prevention, asset protection, whatever it is we call it nowadays, is that at 5:30, everyone knocks off and goes home. The fraudster ain't going home at 5:30. They're there 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, had an hour's sleep, back up it. Because for them, they don't get paid unless they succeed in the job. And then once you get to being paid, why would you not? It was so easy. Why wouldn't I do it again? You know, and nowadays, ransomware, you know, look what happened in Baltimore. You know, like I've been predicting that for years. Yeah. I said, once this thing starts really, like, because that's what I would do, I would shut off a city. Yeah. And I'm going to say, Terry, you cannot go on to Facebook until you pay me $100. Yeah. You cannot go on the internet until you pay me $100. Now, what are you going to do? You're going to go to the police or you're going to pay me $100?
Right.
Right. So for a week, a day, yeah, a month, you might think about it, but you're still not on the internet. Yeah. So I'm going to email you again. Are you ready to pay me now? Right? Now, put that up across millions of people. Right? 17 million people live in London, and I could take the whole of London in less than an hour. Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible just seeing what's going on in the world and how truly vulnerable we are and how dependent we are on Wi-Fi, on internet, on being connected to whatever networks we're on our devices and on everything. You know, everything that we need in order to survive is some type of a computer that can be shut off.
You know, there's 22 billion devices on the planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
That means, you know, wow, most people have got 3 devices in each household.
Right. Yeah, that's about accurate. Mm-hmm.
Right. That's 3 different ways to get to you. 3 different ways to target each individual that doesn't really understand that, oh, look, they didn't even encrypt their home Wi-Fi. They didn't change the password from when they first joined the internet. Yeah.
Yes.
These are all flaws within a weakness that is just there. And we socially engineered the world. It was the worst thing we could have ever have done, yeah? To believe a hack is something that takes place digitally, yeah?
Yeah, the worst part, from my perspective, is all of the voice devices that are right now, they're just growing at mass scale, right? So you have... Yeah. Personally, in my own house, I think I have 2 Alexas, a Google Mini, and some other device floating around. I'm sure that my children use. But those things themselves, I think, are they're opening up households in more ways than we could possibly imagine, from, you know, listening to our information, to accessing the data, you know, that they never delete, apparently, to getting access to all of our accounts. Like, the Alexa has full access into your Amazon account and all of your other devices. I mean, it's just unbelievable the way that we are completely vulnerable and just living our lives, you know, inside out, where everybody can see everything, but we don't know that.
But then voice goes, then the banks go, right? The banks then say, okay, so let's put voice recognition in. So now if you've got all those devices, right, I'm talking to you through a mic that's plugged in to my computer that transmits my voice to you in the States and lets you hear me how I'm talking. Do people really understand what a hacker or cracker is? Do they right. like the labels? Do they like, is there, you know, we might be able to buy ion cannons for a fiver, right, and divert them and take companies down. But the real ones are the ones that see the numbers, the zeros and ones that can change it, that see the flaws in the code, that can recreate the code that links perfectly in the background to believe you to be whoever I am. Right?
Right. So you can recreate a person's voice if you were so inclined.
Deepfakes happen every day now, right? Like, it's going to get much worse. We're worried about it. There's been a really good show here in the UK called The Capture, right, which kind of... You know, it's a real demonization of where face recognition and video footage deep faking could really go. But the reality of it is, you know, there's some really good deep fakes out there, and it won't be long. You know, what banks now, to open up a bank, I have to create a video that I put my little face in and say, hi, this is Tony Sales, and my code number is, right?
Ah, no.
Because we're so reliant on tech, yeah, within the whole industry, we forget about that human element within it. You know, if we were all smarter, we wouldn't get caught out like that. If we all understood the perils of all of it, whether that be from, you know, I'm pretty sure that most people who understand stuff could write an algorithm that would capture every single credit card picture that's ever been taken and shared across Facebook, right? So let's get some videos of Terry. Let's get some videos of Tony. Yeah, and that's manipulate the voice. How do I change the bits, the words? TV editors are amazing people. Yeah, there's so much stuff that you can start to do. Like, if you're a criminal network, why wouldn't you do that with your resources? Especially when you've got, you know, hackers are not very violent people. They're computer people, right? Organized crime comes in violently, which obviously makes people, you know, we're living in a real swordfish moment, I think. I don't know if you've seen that film, but we're definitely getting very close to when stuff like that's going to happen.
Unbelievable. It makes you run for the hills and get off the grid as quickly as possible. But yeah. Tony, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I feel super lucky to have had your time today. To finish things off, what would be the top 4 things that you would like our audience to take away from this episode?
So never share your information, yeah, unless it's absolutely imperative or you've initiated the call, yeah? So if you are ringing your bank, yeah, then you should give them your information, yeah? But if they're calling you, right, out of the blue, you've not been in touch with them, they're trying to put you in fear, always just stand back for a moment and just think about stuff. And if you're unsure, call someone who may know just to check on stuff, yeah? Google, use it. It's all there for you to use. No bank is ever going to make you feel in a position to make a decision right now, yeah? They do good business banks, not bad business, yeah? And that would be bad practice for them. So that's always a good one. The same goes for a business, right? So if you feel, you know, we have on many occasions rung up and claimed to be from IT departments and socially engineered our way through, making the internal member of staff make decisions internally for us, always check, put the phone down, have a little call, go and check with your managers, your line managers, the IT managers that you know that you've had relationships with. Yeah, Go and do that stuff. Never put your passwords by the side of your computer. It's another one, yeah? Like a lot of people, we do a lot of testing, right? I get into a building. I don't even need to bring in the hack team because the passwords are all by the side of the computer. I don't even need the boys to come in to crack everything. Yeah, I can just do it and I'm in. Yeah?
Right.
Times and times I see that kind of stuff, yeah? And just training. Always keep your staff up to date. Even us as individuals, make sure we're aware of the latest stuff that's going on, you know? Anyone can be a victim. If people are interested in fraud and they want to understand it, go and find out as much about it as you possibly can. Like, understand what social engineering is. Understand that people will ring you up and try and steal your information, you know, whether you're a business or a person. And they're always my top points, what I like to give to people.
Thank you so much. So if anybody wants to reach out to Tony for either help with breaking into their own systems, or Tony, you mentioned you have a book coming out.
Yeah, so the book should be out in December. We're kind of, I think we're 3/4 of a way through now. So that's pretty amazing. So it's with a big publisher. It'll be in bookstores all over the place. Please go in and ask for it. If you're in America, that'd be amazing. So that's coming out in December.
And if people wanted to reach out to you, it would be wefightfraud.org, correct?
Yeah, go to wefightfraud.org, yeah, and you'll just look around the website. You'll see the contact page there. You can come through to one of the guys there. And sure, we're glad to have a conversation, but we only want to have conversations with people that really want to be broken and want to understand the processes that they have. Everything we touch, we break.
I like that.
In a good way.
No, I like that a lot. So, yeah, so thank you, Tony, so much. I really appreciate it. I think that it's absolutely fascinating, and you're brilliant in what you do and how you think. So we really appreciate it.
Wonderful. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. I look forward to seeing it. Thanks very much.
If you enjoy this topic, make sure to tune in next week for our chat with Teresa Payton. She is the former White House CIO, the CEO of Fort Alice Solutions, and the author of the book, Manipulated. We discuss tactics on fighting cyber terrorism, fake news, the manipulation and misinformation campaigns, mass mind control, and election fraud. You don't want to miss it. The production of the Amplified podcast has been brought to you by Social Fix Media. Social Fix is a transformational growth hacker agency focused on emerging technology platforms, video and podcast production, content marketing, and overall startup strategy. Social Fix has helped over 300 clients generate millions of dollars in revenue, fundraising, and profit. If you'd like help launching or growing your business, visit socialfix.com. If you like our discussions and would like to support our efforts, be sure to subscribe on Patreon, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, or YouTube. If you have an idea about a topic or know someone who would be a great guest, reach out on our website, amplifiedpodcast.com.